Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today with Evan Renfro, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Evan.
Hey, Ben, how are you?
I'm fine. Dave Anderson with us as well, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Dave, so good to have you on board as well.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
And as an All Politics Day, we'd like to invite our listeners to join in with questions and comments about our menu of topics today. We'll be talking about a little bit later in the program about Iran, the escalating tensions with Iran, election security. Joni Ernst launching her re-election campaign this past weekend. But first, let's start off with the president's re-election campaign launch. Last night in Orlando, he formally opened his re-election campaign. You may be wondering, thinking to yourself, did it ever really stop? And that might be a good question. There was a familiar list of grievances, the witch hunt by the special counsel, according to the president, digs at even the 2016 opponent, Hillary Clinton, last night. And Donald Trump introducing a new slogan, Keep America Great. He pledged to fight for his supporters. There were plenty of them on hand, some 20,000 of them bussed in from all around Florida. He celebrated what he saw as his accomplishments as president. He pointed to the growing economy, more than 140 judicial appointments, tax cuts, deregulation. Let's get a snippet of, I think, 76-minute-long presentation by the president last night in Orlando and have our analysts react. Here's the president from last night.
Many times I said we would drain the swamp, and that's exactly what we're doing right now. We're draining the swamp. And that's why the swamp is fighting back so viciously and violently. For the last 2.5 years, we have been under siege. And with the Mueller report, we won. And now they want a do-over. They want a do-over. Let's do it again. Didn't work out too well. Let's do it again. They want a do-over. No president should ever have to go through this again. It is so bad for our great country. A hoax.
Okay, Dave Anderson, let me start with you. Reaction to that or other things you heard in the president's rally last night?
Well, I think the president's strategy for re-election has become very clear. I think we could have predicted this a while ago. He's going to rally the base. He's talking right to his base, telling them exactly what they want to hear. I really enjoy, actually, the slogan change from Make America Great Again to Keep America Great, because apparently we're having a mission accomplished moment where all the problems in America have been fixed. So now we need to hold on to the greatness that has been achieved, which I think Trump's base really does believe in. They believe that Trump has come into office, has kind of smashed the institutions of government, and is now rebuilding a cleaner, more efficient, better form of government. And for his base, that's a great strategy. The problem is 60% of America steadfastly disagrees with that. And at some point in the campaign, he's going to have to figure out how to get somebody outside of his 40% of core supporters to support him.
Mm-hmm. Evan Renfro, your reaction to last night's rally?
Well, I think Dave's analysis is spot on. The president's made a strategic decision to keep his base highly motivated. The problem is he's made no effort to expand the base. Of course, we see this in his poll numbers. He's the only president, since we've been doing polls, who's never, even for one day, gone over the 50% mark in public approval. So, you know, he's accomplishing his task as he sees it. However, the question remains whether or not that will be effective come election day.
Mm-hmm. We heard the crowd chanting after they were prompted by the president, drain the swamp, drain the swamp. Dave, explain to us, remind us, what is the swamp?
Well, the swamp traditionally is considered to be the D.C. establishment. Anybody who knows the history of Washington, D.C. knows that it was a swamp before it was our capital. And a lot of politicians over the last 40 years have kind of alleged that to go to D.C. is to become corrupt and to sink into the swamp. And so President Trump got this great tagline during the 2016 campaign saying that he was going to drain the swamp, clean it up, get rid of all the corruption in Washington. And his supporters absolutely love it. For analysts who are paying attention to what's happening in Washington, we kind of have no idea what he's talking about because we have more lobbyists in positions of power than we've ever seen before. There are numerous accusations of corruption and just malfeasance among public officials in Washington, primarily those appointed into the Trump administration. So again, this is a great way to ratchet up the energy of the base. But for outsiders and independents and non-Republicans in the country, it's a little confusing to figure out what they're talking about.
Join our conversation as we discuss the Trump rally last night, among other things, on this Politics Day, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you'd like to throw in another aspect of this re-election bid by President Trump, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you're a supporter and would like to point out something you especially enjoyed in last night's rally. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Evan, we've been hearing in past weeks the polls showing President Trump behind in some key battleground states, even some of his own polling showing that. Would we classify him as an underdog at this point?
Well, he did not like those poll numbers. In fact, he fired the pollsters that made him aware of those numbers. I wouldn't say he's an underdog. Don't forget, the president has the bully pulpit. The president has Air Force One. The president has all the trappings that go with being the most powerful office in the country. So, no, and he also has huge revenue streams pouring in from key donors. So I think he feels quite comfortable. He likes campaigning. This seems to actually give him energy and adrenaline. He really started campaigning for 2020, if you remember, on Inauguration Day in his speech. So he's never quit campaigning. He recharges the batteries with these big rallies and sloganeering and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be interesting to see how the caucus process works and what Democrat has to face this.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, traditionally, at least going back years, Iowa has always been identified as a battleground state, given that President Trump, then candidate Trump, won Iowa by, close to 10 percentage points in 2016. Is Iowa, you think, considered a battleground state in 2020?
I think it still might be. Iowa is one of the more confusing states in the union right now because the switch from being an Obama state to being a Trump state was very strong. It was really kind of amazing on Election Day how strongly the state switched to being a Republican state. If you look at the office holders in Iowa, the state legislature is dominated by Republicans. The governor is a Republican. It looks like we are becoming a red state here. I think there are questions, though, about how Trump is going to do in 2020, because his approval numbers are underwater here. More people disapprove of his performance than approve. And I think there's a question about how things are going to go in the next year. Iowa is a very rural state. The economy is largely dependent on agricultural and agribusiness. And those two sectors are being really hurt by the Trump tariffs, with China particularly. And he keeps making noises about maybe raising more tariffs against Mexico or Canada. And I think there is a risk that the economy could turn in the next year. And with President Trump, I think his support is very tied to having a strong, healthy economy. And there's, to my knowledge, nobody is really predicting that the economy is going to strengthen. We've had an unprecedentedly long growth cycle. So at some point, it's going to falter. And if it happens before the 2020 election, I think President Trump is in a lot of trouble in Iowa and across the nation.
Mm-hmm. In 2015, we remember that moment when Donald Trump announced his candidacy, riding down that escalator in Manhattan. This has to be a different sort of campaign. Evan, any thoughts on how this campaign will be different from the, The first one, he was treated as a joke at the beginning. Then it became clearer and clearer that he was knocking his opponents aside in the GOP one by one, and eventually became the nominee and then became the president. How do you suppose this campaign will be different then?
Well, that's right. I would never underestimate the president on this. What's so much different now is that he's not just a joke. He's the president of the United States. And with all the trappings of that office, he has at his disposal for campaigning. And with the backing of not only elected Republicans, but the Republican base is just very, very strong for him right now, including people that might seem counterintuitive. As Dave mentioned, the ag sector in this state, you know, the DMR just had a report the other day on he still has full-throated support from the farmers in Iowa so far. Now, these things can change.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers. Evan Renfro with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. 1-866-780-9100 to get into this conversation on Politics Wednesday. Jeff is joining us from Mason City. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I was just calling because I wanted to point out in 2016 that I think one of the things that Trump did really well was paint Hillary Clinton as a criminal and someone that they wouldn't want to see in office. And so I think he's going to use some sort of the same line of tactics to keep Democrats from getting excited about whoever their candidate might be.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, what do you think of that analysis from Jeff?
I think that is a very smart observation. Jeff is right on point here. The big question is, who is the Democratic nominee going to be, and what is President Trump going to accuse them of? He's already testing out some slogans against certain candidates. I think Sleepy Joe Biden is the one that is sticking the best right now. But I think that's part of his strategy. President Trump is going to rally up his base, and he's going to attack whoever the Democratic nominee is and try to kind of scare people away. He's going to try to convince people to vote for a third-party candidate or to just stay home on Election Day.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of the flavor of that sort of attack from last night, Donald Trump speaking in Orlando.
Our radical Democrat opponents are driven by hatred, prejudice, and rage. They want to destroy you, and they want to destroy our country as we know it. Not acceptable. It's not going to happen.
Okay, so there we see, Evan, the politics of fear, and this is the play, the game plan that the president has in store for us.
Yeah, yikes. You know, you're going to get this socialist label on every. It doesn't matter who the nominee is going to be. It will be painted as some socialist radical that is out to destroy. So that's really good at rallying his base. The difficult, or I think more difficult thing for him to do is to, he has to also suppress the vote, which is made easier by state houses around the country doing things like mandatory voter ID and making it as hard as you can to actually vote. You know, my home state of Texas, you can vote with a concealed handgun permit, but you can't vote with your state-issued student ID. So these are the sorts of techniques. You have to both rally your base and suppress your opponents.
Evan Renfro with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's change to some news from yesterday. The acting defense secretary, Patrick Shanahan, abandoning his pursuit of the top Pentagon position yesterday. Reports emerging of domestic violence in his family. This comes, and we'll talk about it too, as tensions with Iran are rising. Shanahan's former wife accusing him of punching her in 2010, which he has denied. A year later, the couple's teenage son attacked his mother with a baseball bat. Mark Esper, named to be the acting defense secretary. Evan Renfro, let me turn to you first. You are a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst with your military background. What are your thoughts about this episode?
Yeah, this is a curious one. So Shanahan was Secretary of Defense Mattis's deputy this whole time, and he was the heir apparent and has been acting SecDef. Apparently, this whole time, the FBI background check has been ongoing. Now, the president can give top-secret clearance to whomsoever he wants, but apparently with all of these really, frankly, weird details from Shanahan's private life coming out, I suppose Shanahan felt it to be in his best interest to just bow out. And now it's going to look like the Secretary of the Army, also from the industry side, the defense contracting world, will be nominated as Secretary of Defense.
Dave Anderson, comment on the fact that this president has so many acting heads and directors in his administration. That means he is not going to Congress to have them become officially heads of whatever department, in this case, the Defense Department. The president seems to see this as an advantage.
Yes, he clearly does. Currently, I think it's about half of all the appointed officials heading agencies are interims and have not gone through the Senate confirmation process. And the president has said he prefers this because he doesn't want to have his nominees grilled. He doesn't want to have them testify under oath and promise to do things that they may not be able to do and still stay in his good graces. So he has really preferred to just nominate interim people who are directly beholden to him. And he feels like this gives him greater control over what they do.
Okay, let's go to our phones. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Ann is with us from Iowa City. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the program. Coming up on a break, and
Hi.
We have a few other callers, but what's your input?
My husband and I listened to the whole presentation. We thought the president was fabulous. He highlighted what he had done. He highlighted the president, the promises kept. And we firmly support him for 2020. Way to go, Mr. President.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask you, among the accomplishments you see under this president, what is at the top of the list that you feel best about?
Immigration reform, regulatory reform, tax reform, that would be simplification, putting more Americans to work, including women and minorities, and then the small human things like the right to try and VA choice. Also, I think he highlighted that all the Democrats were moving away from the Hyde Amendment and were becoming extreme, in my opinion, abortion proponents. What a shame.
Okay. Ann in Iowa City, thank you very much for your view of this president. Let's go to Gene in Cedar Rapids. Gene, what's your view?
I just have a question because I'm sorry, but I think this president of ours is despicable, and I don't know how people can trust him. They've already said he's lied over 10,000 times, and I don't understand how people think he's a good person to have in office. He's kind of an embarrassment to our country, and I don't understand people how they can support him. I want an answer from somebody. I watch CNN and MSNBC, and I don't understand how people can support this guy.
Mm.
Just answer me.
All right. Gene, all right. Thank you very much. Dave and Evan, there we had back-to-back. Ann in Iowa City, Gene there in Cedar Rapids. They are at the opposite ends of our political spectrum, aren't they, Dave Anderson? We didn't ask Ann this, but, I mean, Gene just doesn't understand Ann, and likewise, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I think those two callers are perfect examples of what is happening in the United States right now. There is about 40% of the country that absolutely loves this president. They believe that he has kept all of his promises, that he has moved forward with his agenda in a way that no other president has ever done before. And they love him. And then there is another, what looks to be about 52% of the country right now, who absolutely detests the president and believes that he is a liar and has not done anything good at all for the country. And I think the real difference is where everybody's getting their information.
Right.
Supporters tend to watch Fox News and listen to conservative talk radio. And those areas are very strong supporters of the president. But if you get your information pretty much anywhere else, you wind up being a strong opponent of the president.
Let's talk about this. Feeds right into a development this week as well. The press secretary of the president for more than 2 years, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, says she's stepping down. We heard a few days ago at the end of the month as the president's press secretary. She plans to return to her home state of Arkansas, contemplate a run for governor there in 2022. The president has four leading candidates under consideration to replace Sanders, rather. Let me get your views before we go to break. Evan, what will Sarah Huckabee Sanders be remembered for, her tenure at the White House?
Well, One is the lack of having press briefings. I mean, when she resigned, it was 94 straight days without the historic, you know, daily press briefing. And the other would be certainly loyalty to the president. And thirdly would be sort of record-breaking levels of misstatements of fact, maybe we'll say, on that. Now, she'll be going down to Arkansas and maybe running for governor, where she'll have a good shot with name recognition. Of course, her father, former governor of Arkansas, well-connected networks in Arkansas. So we haven't seen the last of Sarah Sanders.
Dave, do you think that she has changed the role of White House press secretary permanently? Do you think the next press secretary, whoever that may be, will be made in that mold? The president was evidently very happy with Sarah Sanders' work.
Yes. I think there's a lot of outstanding questions right now about the changes writ large by the Trump administration and whether they will become institutionalized and a permanent change to American government. I don't think a Democratic president would have the same style of spokesperson because they generally would more want to tout what government is doing. But for Republicans, the Republican Party generally doesn't want to use government power to accomplish much. They want to rein in whatever government is doing. And I think President Trump found Ms. Sanders to be a really strong advocate for pretending that everything was rosy when there were problems cropping up. That was her job, is really to paint the administration in a positive light, no matter what the reality was.
And here, as in so many different aspects, Dave, the president, through Twitter, for instance, sidestepping the mainstream media, but also even sidestepping his own press secretary, as we see in the course of his more than 2 years in office, right? Just going directly to the people.
Absolutely. It is a movement from the press secretary and communicating with the public. It's moving away from being kind of openness and transparency, and instead it's moving towards marketing. It is branding. It is creating an image that you try to sell to the public, regardless of what is really happening. And that is something that is largely new.
We have just a few seconds, a minute or so before we go to break. Trump's White House has had the highest senior-level staff churn rate of the past five presidents. Evan, what does this tell you, that the president's people, his team, are coming, going at a record pace?
Well, I think part of it is once people get into these high-level positions and understand what's going on behind closed doors, they begin to get uncomfortable, and they probably want to get out while the getting is good, is on the one hand. On the other hand, you have a president and senior staff who demand total loyalty. And most civil servants want to tell you the truth above loyalty. This president wants loyalty more than truth.
Evan Renfro is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Dave Anderson, our other political scientist from Iowa State University. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dave and Evan, but also continue our Home State View series. I'll be talking with Peter Hirschfeld, reporter at Vermont Public Radio. He'll give us a home state view of Bernie Sanders. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today with political scientist Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa. In just a few minutes, we'll continue with their analysis. Also, we'll squeeze in some more callers. Please stay on the line, callers. We want to get to as many as possible. But now we continue our Home State View series, in which we focus on the individual Democratic presidential candidates for 2020 by talking with someone in the media from their home state who's been covering them for some time. Joining us now for the next few minutes, Peter Hirschfeld is a reporter at Vermont Public Radio. Peter, welcome to our program. Welcome to Iowa Public Radio.
Thank you, Ben. I should say we call a couple colleagues at Vermont Public Radio and I spent about a week in Iowa right in advance of the caucuses in 2016, and we fell in love with your state and we fell in love with Iowans. You all were nothing but welcoming and hospitable. So very good to be with you.
Thank you, Peter. Let's talk quickly about some of the views, a perspective of Bernie Sanders that we may not hear nationwide or here in Iowa. How would people in Vermont describe the leadership of Senator Bernie Sanders? He has such a long history there.
steady, unwavering, and the Bernie Sanders that you listened to during his inaugural mayoral campaign in 1981 is generally viewed as the precise same person that you're hearing on the campaign trail here in 2019. The issues that Bernie Sanders has committed to during the 2016 election cycle, again in 2020, are the same ones that he has been championing at all levels of electoral politics that he's run for. And I think that's what's come to define him for Vermonters, is his insistence on these core issues, core values, and just really zero deviation from that over the course of his political career here in Vermont.
How has his popularity held up in Vermont over the years?
Unfailingly well. You're talking about a guy who squeaked to his first electoral victory in 1981 by 10 votes, literally. Nobody actually expected him to win that. He had been seen as kind of a third-party outsider prior to that, had actually run for governor and U.S. Senate without success in the 1970s. Since then, though, once he became a fixture on the Vermont political scene, he has been really unbeatable. You're talking about a guy that won 86% of the primary vote in the Democratic primary in 2016 when he shared the ballot with Hillary Clinton. And his Senate runs have been equally successful, 67% during the last run, 71% in 2012, and well into the 60s in his first Senate run in 2008. So his appeal has not waned as his national star has risen.
Peter, what can you tell us about the people Bernie Sanders surrounds himself with, his team building, what it's like to work for Bernie Sanders?
Well, you know, the former two, I don't have the inside view what happens inside his Senate offices. As for what it's like to work for Bernie Sanders, we do have some light that's been shed on that. Actually, one of his former campaign staffers authored a book after his successful run for Congress in 1990, and it was not a very flattering portrait that he painted. He talked about a guy who was very mercurial, arrogant, quick to anger, a really contemptuous person that this Steve Rosenfeld character painted a picture of Bernie Sanders, who was sort of unable or unwilling to see the world through the eyes of anyone other than himself. Bernie Sanders dismissed that book as the angry ramblings of a man who felt jilted because he had not been offered a job on Sanders' congressional staff. But Vermont reporters have spoken to a number of staffers since then, mostly anonymous sources, who have said he's an incredibly difficult person to work for, very demanding. Can be, you know, he's a guy that works 24/7 and seems to expect the people under him to share that kind of fealty and devotion to cause that he's demonstrated over the years. That said, that Bernie Sanders has a number of longtime staffers that are incredibly loyal, and they say, you know, can Bernie Sanders be a difficult person to work for? Sure. But he demands excellence. He feels like the issues he's fighting for demand devotion to the cause in a way that requires you to give something of your life that is not like a normal job. And there are certainly plenty of people that have come and left Bernie Sanders' office that feel like they're the better for it.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about it, and people, you have been, I'm sure, in a room at a rally with Bernie Sanders. Address his personal appeal when you're in the same room with him, his style of rhetoric, his appeal to the better nature of people, he would say, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Bernie Sanders is one of these candidates that seems to do far better with big crowds than he does in a one-on-one basis. I can recall a number of rallies that I've been to where he is just remarkable when he's up on that stage. He has the audience wrapped. He's able to communicate with them in a way that really resonates. When you see him, however, do the glad handing after these things are over, he has this pained look on his face often, like there's nothing in the world he would rather be doing than shaking this person's hand or interacting with folks on a one-on-one basis. And I think part of that is because he's become such a, political celebrity, and there are people that have sort of imprinted on him. He's become a real hero of the left for a lot of people.
Right, and I wanted to jump in there before we say goodbye. He's been faulted by his detractors for not having much appeal with the diversity of the Democratic base. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
Well, there are some racial justice leaders in Vermont who would say that it is. They say, you hear Bernie Sanders talking on the national level about issues of racial inequality, but that he has been relatively silent on specific issues facing people of color in his home state of Vermont. They've called him on the carpet numerous times over the years about that, tried to enlist him as an advocate to help advance their mission here at home in Vermont. They say he's really fallen short on that, and they've suggested that racial justice leaders nationally ought to take a closer look at his track record in Vermont as they consider who they want to support in 2020.
Okay, thank you very much. Peter Hirschfeld, reporter at Vermont Public Radio. Some keen insights there from Vermont in our Home State View series of the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates. Peter, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Before we go to a few callers, a reaction from Dave Anderson, Evan Renfro to the Bernie Sanders view we got there from Peter Hirschfeld. Evan, what springs to mind for you?
Well, it's interesting about Senator Sanders being sort of the same guy he's been decades ago. I think that sort of commitment to certain values is something that people can relate to. I think Sanders also deserves a great deal of credit for, from a Democratic perspective at least, for pushing the party to the left in certain ways. Medicare for All, for instance, is now something that people sort of just talk about. But before Sanders, it was one of those positions that many conventional Democrats would stay away from.
Mm-hmm. Joe Biden is the current poll leader. We're a ways away from the Iowa caucuses even. Biden's vision seems to be to return things to the old normal before Trump. Bernie Sanders, though, Dave Anderson, his vision is much bolder, wouldn't you agree? A systematic political and policy change. So I guess those are two theories on how Democrats see a possible win in 2020.
Absolutely. I think this is the major divide within the Democratic Party is the question of, do we focus on winning and put in a lukewarm liberal agenda, or do we focus on fundamentally reorganizing American government and putting in a very progressive agenda? And I don't think the party has a very good sense of where its voters are going to go in the primaries. I think right now, we can see that Joe Biden leads the entire field by quite some margin. But that seems to be because people believe that he will just right the ship, he'll win the election, and he doesn't really have a strong agenda he's running on. People just want to get President Trump out of office. Whereas mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, a lot of other members of the Democratic field are saying it's not good enough to win. We have to change government to something that will help the people use the powers of government to protect the people and accomplish a lot of bold goals.
Dave Anderson with us of Iowa State University, our other political scientist on board this hour, Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa, 1-866-780-9100. We want to talk about Iran in a moment, but let's go to some of our callers who've been waiting. Chris in Des Moines, thanks for waiting. We're running out of time, but we're sure glad you're on the phone with us. What do you want to put in here?
Well, I was telling the guy earlier that part of the problem, we haven't dealt with the race issue yet with the Trump supporters. That's his main base, is the bigots. And that has to be brought out. Bigotry is a big supporter of Trump. And folks that are following him, they fall in that bigotry, because that's what he falls into. And so it has to be talked about. It needs to be talked about, and it's an issue. And until that's why us as people of color, we still have the problems that we are having because we have folks like this president that promotes bigotry, and the following that he has, them are nothing but bigots that is following him. And until we come to that conclusion, we're going to always have these problems.
Chris in Des Moines, thank you for your view. Let's go right to Jacob in Des Moines. Jacob, welcome to the program.
Yes, actually, I was just wondering about, with the Trump supporters, why don't we just call it out as what it is where these, like with Fox News, where it's propaganda. I mean, where you have, you know, information that is inaccurate what the president's saying, and they're spewing this stuff online, like yesterday where the president said he would be draining the swamp, when Mark Esper is now going to be the next secretary of the Army, or acting secretary, where he was the previous vice president of government relations with Raytheon. I mean, complete facts that are inaccurate. Where, how are these people, who are these people, and how are their psyches taking in all this propaganda that's inaccurate?
Jacob in Des Moines, thanks very much. Roger in Lisbon, I'll ask you to be quick as we fly through a few calls here to get various views. Roger, welcome to the program.
Yes, thanks. I'm calling about the issue of the divide between fast thinking and slow thinking. Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner, says we do about 70% of our thinking quick, fast, dirty, no thinking, and about 30% logical. It seems to me very clear that the last election is an affirmation, a confirmation that a primarily gut-level reaction campaign is going to win over a largely rational one. Mm. Now, I don't suggest Democrats surrender the rational, but I think they have to pick up the emotional more, and it seems to me like Bernie and Elizabeth and maybe Cory Booker are as well-suited to doing that as any. So I just like some response on that. How do we contend with the gut level motivation of many of the Trump supporters?
Roger, thank you very much for your call from Lisbon, Iowa. Dave Anderson tapping into a lot of sort of political science there. Do you vote for a policy? Do you vote for a person, a temperament? Do you vote based on your emotion when you see a candidate?
Well, those three callers all have a lot to unpack.
we don't have much time, so quickly, an observation if you had one.
So I guess with Roger's point about fast thinking and slow thinking, there's research out there that suggests that people, the population en masse, sometimes focuses on different things in different elections. Sometimes as a population, we tend to be fast thinkers and just go with our gut. Sometimes we're slow thinkers and we're more logical. I can say that the research that we have in academia suggests that in 2016, when people were asked a whole bunch of things that they believed in before the election, the leading predictor of a vote for President Trump was, in fact, exactly what Chris says it was. It was racism. Attitudes towards African Americans was the leading predictor of voting for President Trump, which suggests that he's tapping into something that is not just a policy issue. He's tapping into a lot of fear that I think white Americans are feeling right now, that America is changing. The demographics of America are changing and rapidly, and they're afraid of what's going to come. And it's very difficult to talk people out of that fear.
Let's talk quickly, Evan Renfro, while we have you here with your credentials as a former intelligence analyst with the U.S. Air Force. Earlier this week, the U.S. announcing the deployment of more troops to the Middle East amid rising tensions between Tehran and Washington, fears of a confrontation between Iran and the U.S. mounting since attacks on two oil tankers. That was last Thursday at the entrance to the Gulf there, that critical strait there. On Monday, Tehran saying it would soon breach a key element of the 2015 international pact, limiting its nuclear program. Not much time, I'm sorry, Evan. So much to unpack, but what do you see going on?
Well, this is heating up. This is how you go from cold wars to hot wars. Mike Pompeo is just briefing members of Congress today behind closed doors, trying to make the argument that Iran is somehow tied to al-Qaeda. Now, this is a key argument because it would allow the original authorization for the use of military force passed in the aftermath of 9/11. It would allow the president and his role as commander-in-chief to bypass Congress and engage in armed conflict with Iran if that connection was made. The problem is there is not a connection with al-Qaeda. There's no reason to believe that Tehran and al-Qaeda have any sort of romantic relationship. After all, you're dealing with a Sunni radical organization of al-Qaeda versus the Shia regime of Iran. These folks do not like each other. But watch this discourse or this narrative play out. And this is a way in which the president can flex his muscles as commander, all of which, of course, John Bolton is pushing very hard to do. So this is how we escalate. And meanwhile, our EU friends are in quite a bind because the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear agreement with Iran. So now Iran is saying, well, we're going to have more fuel. Now, what they haven't done yet, and this would be an important escalatory step, is if they said not just more fuel, but we're going to process it to a higher purity in order to make that nuclear device. Right now, the rule is they can't go above 5%. They're talking maybe in the future we'll go to 20%. Well, that is when it gets really spooky, and Bolton is going to be able to make a more persuasive argument to the president for action, because once you get to that 20%, it's not that hard to get to that 90% that you need to make a working nuke. Now, the timeline here is about a year. If Iran was to escalate like they say they have, it all depends on what the EU tries to do here. On the one hand, EU doesn't want to upset any more the United States. It's very hard to do global business if you're in violation of U.S. sanctions. On the other hand, you know, Iran is in compliance with the agreement, by all accounts. So it's just not a great situation to be in.
Very quickly, let's pivot back to domestic politics. Our U.S. Senator Joni Ernst officially kicking off her reelection campaign over the weekend at her annual Roast and Ride event with a call to stamp out socialism. Dave, let me hand this to you. How do you size up her position going into her reelection campaign?
I think Senator Ernst is starting off with a strong position. I think the people of Iowa largely like her. They support her. I think she ran a really strong campaign when she won her original seat. And I think she starts off with a lot of advantages. It's going to be tough to have a Democratic challenger come in and really challenge her on many things. So it's going to be an uphill battle for the Democrats.
How much is President Trump a factor in her Senate reelection?
Right now, I don't think very much. I think a wise challenger might try to make it a factor and might paint Senator Ernst as in President Trump's pocket. And that might be enough to convince people to vote against her if you can convince people that that's the fact.
Mm-hmm. Democrats needing to pick up, I think, 4 seats in 2020 to regain the majority of the Senate. Dave, quick thoughts on what will determine whether the Democrats can do that?
The economy. I think right now most people in America have made up their mind on the president, and the president can influence elections down ballot. I think really the question is, does the economy continue to be strong or does it start sliding?
Mm-hmm. Okay. One bombshell we've saved for the end on this politics day, for our listeners anyway. For me, a bombshell that I took in a few days ago. Dave Anderson, you're leaving Iowa State University to go where?
Well, my wife and I have been offered a wonderful opportunity at one of the best universities in England. So we're moving to Durham University, just south of Newcastle, where we will continue to study American politics, but also be able to blend in a study of British politics as well.
So we shouldn't interpret this as you fleeing the U.S. political scene.
No, but sometimes I do like to think that that's what I'm doing.
Well, Dave, we have enjoyed your analysis here, and maybe we'll have that occasionally in the future as well. But you've been such a wonderful and keen analyst here for many years with us. I know I speak for many Iowa Public Radio listeners when I say we will miss you and your analysis dearly.
Well, thank you, Ben. I have to say I've really appreciated being a part of Iowa Public Radio. I think this station, all the just fantastic people I've worked with here, really create the opportunity for democracy to succeed. I know that's a drastic statement, but in order for democracy to succeed, people have to be well-informed. They have to think about both sides of an argument, and they have to be able to trust the news they hear, and I think Iowa Public Radio does that.
Well, thank you very much for those words. Dave Anderson, you be well. To you and your family, all the best.
Thank you.
Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. You heard it. Heading off to England soon. Evan Renfro, you're sticking around, right?
That's right, Ben. Appreciate it.
We sure hope you are, because we enjoy your analysis as well. Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Evan, thanks for stepping into our studio today.
You bet.
River to River, available as a podcast. You can go to iowapublicradio.org or download our Iowa Public Radio app. Don't miss a discussion here on River to River, or share it with others. That's the best way to do it. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help today from Chris Fenton as well. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.